The message is entitled, Testing the Lord. It is the seventh in Bishop John W. Howe's series entitled, Exodus Meditations.
Exodus 17. Read the first paragraph. From the wilderness of Sin, the whole congregation of the Israelite journeyed by stages, as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. The people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to the Lord, "What shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me." The Lord said to Moses, "Go on ahead of the people and take some of the elders of Israel with you. Take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. I will be standing there in front of you on the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock and water will come out of it so that the people may drink." Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He called the place Massah and Meribah because the Israelites quarreled and tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Literal meaning of Massah and Meribah, testing and quarreling. Pattern is becoming very familiar, isn't it? God provides and the people rejoice, but let there be just the briefest moment in which the Lord asks them to take a few steps by faith instead of by sight, and they resume their complaining again. Delivered from Egypt, they complain at the Red Sea. Delivered from the Red Sea, they complain at Marah, where the water was brackish, you remember, and undrinkable. God miraculously heals the water, turns it into sweet, drinkable water, and they complain in the wilderness for the lack of food. God sends manna and quails, and here they are complaining again at Rephidim, once again because there's no water. The tragedy, really, of the book of Exodus, the tragedy of this whole epoch in holy history is that their faith is not becoming cumulative. You know, that's the point of taking us through these kinds of experiences, is that they begin to build. God has shown himself over and over and over again eager to provide. More eager to provide, in fact, than they are to believe him for it. In fact, one of the earliest revelation names that he gives himself is Jehovah Jireh, or Yahweh Jireh. Back to Abraham, literally, "The Lord will provide. I am your provider." That's who I am. I am your provider. And he's shown himself to be that over and over again. And yet, every time there's a new crisis, a new need, there they are complaining and doubting and disbelieving and angry and murmuring. Bishop Alfred Stanway, who I quote with some frequency, one of the great heroes in my life, missionary bishop in Eastern Africa for 20 years, had a little saying that the man of God, the woman of God, the person of God, doing the work of God, according to the leading of God, and in the way that God have that person do, will never lack for the resources of God. Person of God, doing the work of God according to the leading of God and in the way that God directs, will never lack for the resources of God. Do you believe that? Sometimes there are patches in the middle where it's pretty thin, but I think you can take that to the bank. The man of God, the woman of God, doing God's work in God's way according to his leading, will never lack ultimately for the resources of God. God has provided for their needs and gotten them over, under, around, or through every obstacle, and yet the moment there's a new problem, they panic. Before I'm too hard on them, I need to see myself in this story. I'll share with you a moment that sort of echoes with this story in my life. We were We were into a building project at Truro Church in Northern Virginia. Major expansion of the main church building. God had given extraordinary provision for our every need regarding that, and had led us with incredible clarity. If I were to tell you the whole story, it would take much too long. But he made it absolutely clear that this was his leading to us. It wasn't, you know, a few people against a few others fighting the thing out. The Lord really spoke with unmistakable clarity, and he provided for our needs. We established a line of credit with the bank, and we never had to dip into it. We were already at that point giving away 50% of our income on a more than $1 million budget. And here we were into $1.5 million expansion program with no endowment, mind you. And God provided sufficient manna, sufficient money to meet each one of our cost needs without having to go borrow the money. We did that whole expansion without having to borrow money. One of the early problems we ran into was matching the bricks. In a Georgian style architecture, and we had bricks of a certain size and a certain pattern, and as our builder began to look around, he discovered that these were in fact an unusual size. They were oversized bricks, and you don't just crank out a bunch of bricks at a brick factory. I mean, you have to resize all of your molds if you're going to have this particular, and you can't use some other size brick. It's part of the existing building. The other problem was they were darker red than most bricks that are being made today. And so our builder began to look around all over the country, and we all began to pray about it. And do you know, he found a company in North Carolina that said, well, yes, as a matter of fact, we have some oversized bricks, just the size you're looking for. Said we had a very large order a couple of years ago, and it was such an unusual order that we decided to make extra in case anybody ever needed them. We have 21,000 bricks available. How many do you need? 21,000. They said, oh, but there's one little thing we ought to tell you about. Accidentally, we left them in the kiln too long, and they are deeper red than... We put up a little wall of the new brick right in front of the old brick so people could see it. The match was absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, you could not have had a more perfect match. And God provided in that way. And we saw him putting together this massive project. We were in that church every Sunday during the whole time that it was being torn apart and put back together. The Lord gave to our builder a plan for how we could clean things up every Friday afternoon. We had curtains hanging down the sides. We were literally blowing the sides out and leaving columns, posts, standing where a wall had been and adding 16 feet in each direction. And he was standing in the shower one day, pondering, how are we going to keep using this space? And he sort of brushed up against the shower curtain. And he said, that's it. We could hang curtains from the ceiling. During the week, we'll pull up the curtains and be doing our work. Come weekend, we'll drop the curtains, we'll clean up everything inside, and we didn't have to vacate that building once during this whole building project. Came around Christmas time. We are well into the project, and we're beginning to build the columns, you know, where we had steel girders holding up the roof. Used to be in the middle of the wall, and we're building them into columns, and somebody suddenly noticed what nobody had spotted, including the architect on our plans, namely that these columns lined up with each other visually and became visually a solid wall as far as 40% of the people who would be seated in the new areas were concerned. Can you picture what I'm saying in your mind? You've seen a line of columns, and if you're standing in the right place, they line up with each other, and it looks like a wall. You picture the problem? So we're adding all these new seats, and 40% of them can't see anything? We had an emergency vestry meeting. You better believe we had an emergency vestry meeting. We walked through this building. We envisioned every possible alternative that we could think of. We talked about putting the altar in the middle of the church. We did everything Here's what we went home from that vestry meeting thinking. Here's how we're going to solve the problem. 40% of the people in the transepts are not going to be able to see anything. We're going to hang television monitors on the inside of each one of the columns in a colonial church, right? What a wonderful solution that is. And as we're walking out feeling absolutely, totally deflated, I mean, how, God, how could you have allowed this to happen? How could you have led us into a place of such total embarrassment and such frustration? One of the vestrymen said to me, you know, I'm certain there is a very simple solution, and God's going to show it to us. And I, the spiritual leader of this faithful congregation, looked him dead in the eye and I said, not this time. The Lord had a solution. It was so remarkably simple. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but the Lord revealed his solution to the junior warden almost in an audible voice. He was sitting having his lunch one day, and the Lord spoke to him almost as audibly as I'm speaking to you. And he said, move the pulpit right in line with the columns. Can you picture this? Here's this line of columns, and here's the pulpit. To everybody on this side, they see me from this side, and to everybody on this side, they see me from this side. It's like standing in the doorway between two rooms. If you've ever had a big meeting in your home, you stand in the doorway and everybody in both rooms sees you. Footnote to the story. In order to move the pulpit into the wall, so to speak, according to the blueprints, we had a problem because right there, right exactly where the pulpit needed to be located, was one of these steel girders holding up the roof. Only we dug into the wall and guess what? It wasn't there. And nobody knows why. The blueprint said, that's where the steel girder is. We dug into the wall and it wasn't there. 20 years earlier, when they built the building, they left out a girder where we needed to put the pulpit. Not this time. Do you hear the Israelites saying that? Time and time and time and time again, the Lord has proved himself faithful. And here's a new need, and what's their solution? Not this time. Jehovah Jireh. Yahweh Jireh, I am your provider. Faith ought to be cumulative, and so often it's not. So often it's not. That's the tragedy. One thing I've observed over the years, and I don't know if I can say this without seeming to be self-serving, but I believe it's true, is that when people's faith in God is fragile, they will invariably criticize the leadership. I just note that. When the people's faith begins to waver, when the crisis is there and they don't see the solution, they will criticize the leadership. Look at how they beat up on Moses over and over again. Let me quickly add that not all criticism is unwarranted. Not all criticism is a matter of distrusting God. Sometimes the leader needs to be criticized. Sometimes God will speak to the leader through the criticism, especially if it's offered in love and in an attempt to be constructive. But it has been my experience, and I've observed it over and over again. I think it's true in the overwhelming majority of cases in Scripture that when people start failing to exercise their faith in God, they also begin murmuring against their leaders. Moses' response is so marvelous. Why do you quarrel with me? Question mark. Why do you test the Lord? Question mark. Do you see that when the Lord is leading the leader, to quarrel with the leader is to test the Lord? Do you see that? To find fault with Moses when he is simply following God is, in fact, to come against the Lord himself. If I were preaching this little sermon to that generation of Israelites, you do know what they'd be saying, don't you? Yes, I see the principle, but in this instance, Moses is wrong. brought us here into the wilderness and there's no water. I'm not criticizing God, I'm criticizing Moses. No, you're not. Moses has done exactly what God told him to. I don't want to beat this to death, but just let it register. We live in an age of such, what shall I say, self-importance and pride in our own opinions. I'm convinced that one of the single most destructive elements in the life of any congregation or any fellowship group is the unwillingness of the people of God to believe that the Lord can speak to and work through whoever is charged with making the decision. That doesn't mean don't be critical. Doesn't mean don't offer your criticisms. Offer them in love, but trust the leaders and trust the Lord to lead the leaders. The way that gets expressed today is, I feel I have a right to be part of this decision. It affects my life. Who are they? Or who is he? Or who is she to make this decision for me? Let me tell you what Scripture says to that. Quoting from Romans 12, I say to everyone among you, not to think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. For as in one body we have many members, and not all the members have the same function, so we who are many are one body in Christ, and individually we're members one of another. It doesn't say don't think highly of yourself, it says don't think too highly of yourself. And don't think that you've got to make every decision. Because not all members have the same function. I do not need to be part of every decision. There's a responsibility on the part of the leadership not to lord it over others or to be arbitrary or insensitive or authoritarian. But there's a corresponding responsibility on everybody's part to trust the motives of the leader, unless there's demonstrable cause not to, and believe that God can lead through that person or those persons. This pattern plagued Moses for the next 40 years. And early on, we see him going immediately to God with the problem. That's all the leader can do. If he or she has been faithful to the Lord, and the people are criticizing and complaining, all you can do is take it back to God himself. Moses learns that early on. With one notable exception, and we'll come to that in just a moment. But as always, we see God's provision being made available here, and he gives very explicit instruction. Take the rod and strike the rock. And I want to remind you that that's the same shepherd's staff that Moses had back in Exodus 4 when God first called him. And you remember that story, how he told him to throw it down and it turned into a snake? And then he told him to pick it up again and it turned back into his rod. And I coined the little phrase that God took the snake out of it. It becomes a parable for us that we need to throw down at the Lord's command. We need to throw down whatever it is we're hanging on to and let him take the snake out of it. Prior to that, it was the rod of Moses, and after that, it becomes the rod of God. And it's that same rod that Moses used to demonstrate superiority over Pharaoh's magicians. You remember that encounter? Moses throws down his rod, and Pharaoh says, that's no big deal. My magicians can do the same thing. They throw down their rods, and they become snakes. Only Moses' snake swallows up their snakes. It's that same rod that he uses to strike the Red Sea, and it parts, and the children of Israel go across dry shod. They get to the other side, and he strikes the ground again, and the sea comes crashing in on Pharaoh's army. Now the rod of God becomes the tool that Moses will use for the next 40 years to provide water in the desert. There are two footnotes to this story. I want to hold a finger here, because we're coming right back to Exodus 17, but turn to Numbers chapter 20. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers 20. And I want to look at this footnote. The Israelites, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh. Miriam died there and was buried there. Now there was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and against Aaron. The people quarreled with Moses and said, "Would that we had died when our kindred died before the Lord. Why have you brought the assembly of the Lord into this wilderness for us and our livestock to die here? Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to bring us to this wretched place? It is no place for grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, and there's no water to drink." And Moses and Aaron went away from the assembly to the entrance of the tent of meeting. They fell on their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the staff and assemble the congregation, you and your brother Aaron, and command the rock before their eyes to yield its water. Thus you shall bring water out of the rock for them. Thus you shall provide drink for the congregation and their livestock." What's the same in this story as the previous one? The complaining people. It's almost the identical story, right? What's different? Exactly. Notice that. He says, take the rod in your hand, but he says, speak to the rock. Simply command it, and it will bring forth water. Verse 14, Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. I'm sorry, I jumped to the wrong place. Verse 9, Moses took the staff from before the Lord as he had commanded him. Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, "Listen, you rebels, shall we bring water for you out of this rock?" Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his staff. Water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their livestock drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not trust in me to show my holiness before the eyes of the Israelites, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them." These are the waters of Meribah, where the people of Israel quarreled with the Lord, and by which he showed his holiness. This is the one great, terrible moment of weakness and sin on Moses' part, for which, what an incredible penalty, he who has been privileged to lead this people for 40 years through their desert wanderings, he comes to the edge, finally, of the promised land, and he's allowed to look over the border into Canaan, but not to cross over himself, not to personally lead them in 40 years later. It's a terrible thing, says the book of Hebrews, to fall into the hands of the living God. You do know he is a living God, don't you? You notice what is going on here? I mean, your heart has to go out to Moses. I mean, this kind of complaining continually, it finally gets to you. But he really loses his cool in two ways. God said, speak to the rock. Don't strike it. Speak to the rock this time. Previously he said, strike the rock. This time he says, speak to it. And Moses doesn't pay any attention. He doesn't simply speak to it. He strikes it, thinking it's a magic wand, I suppose. The power's in the stick. No. The power's in God, and he's using the stick. And this time he said, don't use the stick. But much more than that. Hear now, you rebels, must we? No. He's simply the tool in the hand of God, just like the stick is the tool in the hand of Moses. That's one footnote. Moses loses his cool. Remember Bishop Stanway's saying, God's man doing God's work in God's way? See, it's not just enough to belong to the Lord. And it's not just enough to have a sense that he's calling you to do something. The question is, are you doing it in his way? Or are you incorporating worldly wisdom or your own great expertise or doing it the way you did it before because that's the way you always did it? You know, seven last words of the church are, "We never did it that way before." Right? Now, we know how we're supposed to bring forth water. We're supposed to strike the rock, right? That's how we've always done it. Except that God said this time, speak to the rock. It's an important footnote, isn't it? Maybe you've heard that story. I love the story of two men who met each other in the city of Jerusalem, and they got chatting with each other and suddenly discovered that both of them had previously been blind, and both of them had an encounter with the Lord Jesus and were healed by him. And the one man says to the other, well, tell me how he did it. And the other one said, he just spoke. He just said, be healed, and I was healed. And the first guy says, no. He's got to spit on the ground and make clay and rub it on your eyes and send you to the... You get it? The Lord isn't limited to doing it one way simply because that's the way he's done it time after time. He can do it that way, or he can do it some other way. He can simply speak to the man and the man is healed. It's amazing if you really start to analyze the patterns, the diversity of patterns in Jesus' response to the people who come and ask him for healing. You know, sometimes he leaves what he's doing and goes to where the person is. Sometimes he sends a messenger and tell him your faith has made you well. One time he's en route to take care of one man's daughter who is on the point of death and as a matter of fact has died before he gets there. And a woman comes up to him and lays hold of the hem of his garment and he feels power going out from him. One time he waits 4 days to make sure his very good friend Lazarus, who is desperately ill, makes sure he's dead and buried so that the miracle can become even greater. And we raise him from the dead. The Lord doesn't have just one pattern. Sometimes he lays hands on, sometimes he puts fingers in ears and unstops them. One time he spits on a man's tongue. How would you like that one? Sometimes he makes clay and rubs it on their eyes. And sometimes he doesn't do a blessed thing. He simply says, be well. God's person doing God's work in God's way will never lack for God's resources. How shall we approach this one, Lord? Shall we approach it in the strength of our great expertise, having done this thing over and over and over again? Now I know how to do it. I can do it. I can handle it. Boy, as soon as you say I can handle it, look out. Disaster is on the horizon. Must we bring forth water for you, rebels? For your great sin. Because you did not honor me, you're not going to have the privilege of bringing this people into the land of promise. Wow. Never, 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 never forget who it is that's supplying the resources. The other footnote is back in Exodus 17. And it's a much happier footnote. The battle with the Amalekites. Exodus 17 and verse 8. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, choose some men for us and go out, fight with Amalek, the Amalekites. And tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. Whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary, so they took a stone and put it under him and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side, so his hands were steady until the sun set. And Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this as a reminder in a book and recite it in the hearing of Joshua. I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called it, the Lord is my banner. He said, a hand upon the banner of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Again, that's one of those revelation names of God. Yahweh, my banner. I am your banner. I am your banner of victory, Yahweh Nisi, just like Yahweh Jireh earlier. Isn't that a marvelous picture? The battle with the Amalekites is fought in the power of God. It's not going to be decided on the basis of who has the most tanks and M1s and B-14s. And it's going to be fought on where the rod of God is. So long as the rod of God is being held high as a banner of victory, the Lord's people prevail. But when Moses grows weary and the rod of God begins to droop, the Amalekites begin to prevail. Note, the people had the right leader, and the leader had the right equipment, but when Moses' hands drooped, the battle went against them. And victory was not theirs until they supported their leader. Hang on to that one. I made the comment, maybe I beat it too hard, that when people's faith begins to falter, they blame the leader. Notice this is the flip side of that. They prevailed when they supported the leader. And that's what we've got to do for each other. The writer to the Hebrews picks up on this passage and this illustration with a general comment that he makes in chapter 12. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Lift your drooping hands. Here's the image. Lift up your hands. Strengthen your weak knees, because we all grow weary. And the imagery there that he doesn't explicitly comment on is support each other in doing that. We need each other's help. So that what is lame won't be put out of joint, see? If you try to carry that burden when you're lame and you keep trying to do that and trying to do that, it's just going to get worse. But instead, it'll be healed. Support not only the leader then, but support each other. Support each other. So that weakness will not become injury, but because we support each other, it'll grow strong. Joshua fit the battle of Jericho, and Moses fit the battle of the Amalekites. And the victory was based on where the rod of God is. And I want to say to you that the victory in our lives, whatever the battle, is always going to be decided on where the rod of God is. Don't forget that that's merely an instrument. The power belongs to God. Lift high the banner of His victory and support each other in holding that banner up. And see the salvation of our God. Amen.